you know, many data teams being downsized right now. So expect to do a lot more with a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
And now you want us to tack on this other technology and maintain that while we're doing everything else. You know, and the question is like, well, what's wrong with just using, you know, Snowflake, Redshift, Databricks, Fabric, whatever. And maybe we come back to this later.
Hello and welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. I'm Carsten Bange, founder and CEO of Bark, and my guest today is Joe Rees, a well-known podcaster and data engineer by training and by conviction. And what we will talk about is obviously trends and latest developments in data engineering, such as how does AI change the game? There's data engineering for AI systems now that have different requirements, but AI also changes how data engineering is being done. Just think about code generation. We'll talk about open table formats, a super interesting development in the data lakehouse space. And we get his view on where things are heading in terms of the formats, the different formats there are, production readiness and other important things. We also talk about automation and ask the question, why do so many people use code-based approaches when there are tools that can automate a lot of things here? These and other topics will help you to get an update on what's happening in data engineering. Sometimes we geek out a little bit, but overall, I think it's a great way to stay up to date in data engineering. Enjoy the episode. Hi, Joe. Great to have you on my podcast today.
Hey, danke. Good to see you.
Joe, you are a well-known podcaster, but also an expert in data engineering. And my initial question to you would be, what are the big trends you're seeing? What are the big topics in data engineering? Where are things changing? Where are things, what's happening in that field?
It's interesting talking to you because you run a great research firm. And so I'm sure that, you know, you're used to seeing cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Come and go. I feel like we're at one of those right now. It's kind of what's old is new again. But what's new is new again as well, right? So we can talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
What's old is new again is, you know, classically, we've gone through infrastructure waves, whether we're talking different ways of storing data, different ways of querying and retrieving it and so forth. You know, the big, I'd say one of the big talks of the town right now, so to speak, is the open table formats.
Mm-hmm.
And what does this do to the evolution of lakehouses? So obviously Iceberg and then Hudi and so forth. So that's definitely, I think that's, so there's some questions on whether or not that's, you know, going to see widespread adoption. And what does this mean for the entire ecosystem of, you know, cloud data platforms, cloud data warehouses and so forth? Whether this means everybody's going to be competing on the virtue of the query engines all of a sudden or, But it's you know, on the other hand, it's also a question of complexity. Are we entering a new version of the Hadoop days where companies were investing in technologies that were potentially overly complicated for what they need? And I think on top of this, obviously, you know, this is the year of AI agents.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone's trying to figure out what does an AI agent look like for data engineering, just like we've been trying to figure out what AI for data engineering looks like. So that's I think broadly, those are some of the big macro trends happening in data engineering. At the same time, again, you know, we kind of talked about what's old is new again and what's new is new again. But what's also it's interesting because if we talk about that from start off in the technology angle, which you kind of touched on there. There's also something I'm seeing where old practices are seeing new light and attention. So things like data modeling, data governance, data management, all these things that I think were sort of written off potentially for dead for a while. I mean, they're back. They're back with a vengeance. And so I think this is it's timely. But at the same time, we're also moving beyond the traditional world of tabular data. We're now living in a world where there's text, images, audio, video, and now we're, I think, all trying to figure out how do we, you know, combine and find value from you know, multimodal data sets. It's just a big departure from where we were before, where, again, we used to live in a very table-centric world, but that was sort of like, I think, believing that the universe revolved around the earth. or something. So the perspectives have shifted a bit. So those are a few of the things I'm seeing, right? And then obviously the question is, what does data engineering do for AI? And then what does AI do for data engineering? And we can certainly unpack those. But yeah, there's I think it's an exciting time to be in the field. If I were to pick a time to be in it, which I've been in several epochs, I suppose, of this field, in data generally and data engineering specifically. But I think it's an exciting time. And plus, the other part is the commoditization of real-time systems is the other one. Streaming, I think, will be much more of a first-class citizen over the coming decades. So all these combined, it's fascinating. And yet, we're still dealing with the same problems we always deal with. Right?
Yeah.
Are we getting value from our data? Is it believable? Justifying the cost and the existence of data teams. These are the old well-worn themes that we're now returning to. I don't think they ever left, but anyway, that's a few things I'm observing.
No, absolutely. So let's drill into a few of those topics. We definitely cannot touch on all of them in 30 minutes. No way. But let's pick some out. First of all, I completely agree. Many things really come in cycles. Actually, I have my hypothesis that for many things, it's a 10-year cycle when things come back, and I can show this, but that's a different discussion. But let's maybe start with AI. I mean, that's the topic that is top of mind for many. Some can't hear it even anymore, but anyway. So that's also a topic we do a lot of work on, this data engineering for AI and AI for data engineering. And let's start with that. First of all, data engineering for AI, what do you see are the biggest changes or the new challenges to tackle here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few threads to this, right? I'll give you some examples. Data engineers and software engineers, at least the ones that I know and talk with on a daily basis, they weren't interested in AI or machine learning maybe 3-4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, oh, that's for the data scientists. That's for the machine learning engineers and so forth. And magically, you know, almost overnight, everybody who wasn't interested in machine learning and AI now has a very vast interest in it. Mm-hmm. Right? So data engineering for AI is it's manifesting itself in a few ways. First, how do we, query, store, process unstructured data sets alongside our structured data sets. That's the big one that I see a lot of my colleagues are working on now. And, data engineering for AI, again, it's about, it's interesting, the notion of data quality. One of these things, in data governance, these are written off as sort of nice to haves, don't really need them. That's the impression, at least, where I am in America. It's like, they slow us down. Let's move faster. So data engineering for AI is also manifesting itself in, I think, a renewed attention to data quality. For precisely, the obvious thing that, the quality of your models, directly depend on the quality of your data. This is, I don't think this is up for debate at this point. So, but I think a lot of people have, because we messed around and found out the hard way about this. So, so these are a couple of things, right? And then obviously, a lot of attention to, how do you integrate these models, whether open source or, API based, into your workflows, whether these are data engineering workflows and so forth. And I think more broadly in the company, right? So, if last year was the year of LLMs and chatbots in the business, this year seems to be the year of agents in the business. And so people are trying to figure out, how do I integrate these into our workflows? What are the use cases for them, right? I mean, this is still a topic for debate. I'm going to go a bit off tangent on the topic, but so there's an article in The Information, was it today or yesterday, talked about how Salesforce was having some trouble selling Agentforce, right? I mean, this is like the big thing they're betting the company on, and it's a hard sell. Because I don't think it seems like a lot of companies are still trying to figure out where do you integrate this into the company, and is it worth it, right? I mean, but I think long term, we'll get past these hiccups, and you'll see, probably agents everywhere, but the enterprise aspects of it too, I think, are still there's still some question on that. But that's back to data engineering. These are the sorts of questions that now data engineers are starting to ask. Is okay, so now if we're going to be asked to do agents and build the data systems that will power these agents, how do we do that? So this is what I'm seeing. Now, to reverse the question, how does AI help data engineering? I mean, the obvious one is code generation and copilots and stuff like that. And there's probably a single digit number or a single digit percent of my friends that still avoid copilots. So I think almost everybody's using some flavor of it, right? Whether that's, Cursor or WinSurf, or even just, I use GitHub Copilot because I'm pretty old school, but I mean, even to even say that GitHub Copilot is old school is pretty hilarious when you think about it, because it's not that old. But even, what's that?
How old is it? Like 1 year or so?
Yeah, exactly.
Already
it's
old?
It's not like a week old, yeah. So it's old. So this is, it's funny because these are just I would say the things that a lot of data engineers are working with now. And then, I'm starting to see more and more LLM-based workflows and traditional ELT and ETL tools where you can prompt and spin up infrastructure, spin up pipelines. So I think that's interesting. I do wonder how this is going to change the workflow of data engineers. Are you going to have to do like prompt reviews along with your code reviews before you accept things into version control? So I think some of the practices we're still trying to figure out, but this is pretty early days. It reminds me a lot of maybe developing the web back in the late 90s, where you had HTML and you had other things like Dreamweaver and other tools from that are quite ancient these days. But because it's reinvigorated me in a lot of ways. I think I'm excited.
Okay. Yeah, a lot happening. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit further on these LLM-based workflows. So you mean like what we traditionally developed as data pipelines, huh? Or ETL pipelines, and then assembled them in some way of workflow. How does that change with LLMs?
Oh, it changes it potentially a lot. And so this is... And I can get into the pros and cons of this and some of the things I've been writing about. But it does change the nature of the type of work that we do and the way we do it. If you can either through a voice prompt or a chatbot spin up, I want to say I want to build a connector from this source to this destination written in this specific file format, say Parquet, and drop it here. You could spin that up pretty quick. I've used tools like this. It's not hard. Now, whether or not it works or not, that's a different story. Did it set up the correct permissioning schemes and all that? I think this is what's happening now. The consequence of this, though, is something I've been thinking a lot about. This is actually a talk I gave recently in Austria, where I called it the Great Pacific Garbage Patch of AI and data slop. Slop is a term used to describe kind of low quality outputs of AI and LLMs and image generators. But potentially this is one of the big problems we'll be dealing with, is that it now becomes so easy to generate code. It becomes so easy to generate infrastructure and data sets that, everything becomes disposable, but almost too disposable. You don't build systems that last. You build systems that can be regenerated in slightly better or slightly worse fashion. And so this is, from an engineering perspective, it's a bit of a mind shift for sure. Because you're used to building systems that should behave deterministically and idempotently. And now, I don't know, maybe they don't. And so I think more than ever, it's going to, engineers are going to really have to know what they're looking for and what they're doing. Because otherwise you're making some pretty drastic assumptions that your prompt is going to lead to a robust infrastructure that works with guarantee, right? Any engineer who's built anything will tell you that it's hard.
Mm-hmm. So you say the quality of the output right now of any LLM-based, let's say, creation, production is not yet sufficient.
It varies a lot. I think the code that's generated is, I think by most estimations, it's good enough to get you about 70% of the way there, mm-hmm. maybe 80. Mm-hmm. But as you know, in engineering, it's that last 20 to 30% that's always the hard part. That's what you get paid to do, is solve these hard problems. And, I hear these comments like, oh, anybody can spin up an app now. Mm-hmm. Right. It's just that easy. I can make an iPhone app. I can make Uber tomorrow. Right. And I think that's, you can definitely scaffold, I think, a pretty interesting MVP of something. But at least in the current state, the way that the technology is, I don't think I would trust it to do 100% of the work.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's shift gears here and talk a little bit about what you see in the Lakehouse space. I personally find the open table format super interesting in terms of, enabling scalability, often also cost efficiency and other advantages. And, what's your take on that? Yeah. So how popular are they really? And what's the future here?
I mean, there's no shortage of people who are talking about them on a daily basis. I think as far as like real world production workloads, I have yet to see widespread adoption, but I think that's coming. All the big cloud data vendors have, put their stake in the ground, particularly with Iceberg. And so we'll see how this goes. I think the jury's still out in terms of, the amount of noise that we see versus the amount of adoption.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right now. So I think this will be a more interesting discussion probably this time next year.
Yeah.
So, because the Snowflake Summit is going to be coming up, and Databricks is coming up in June. And those are the two big ones that typically push, especially the open table formats, forward. So yeah. There's a lot of activity in the space right now for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And, what are the biggest obstacles? I hear vendors talking about, well, security is not yet production ready, or a lot of things are not where they should be or could be, and so we can really use it in a large scale productive environment. Is that something you see too?
For sure, security is a big one. Questions about role based access controls, stuff like that, right? Because like as it stands right now, if you're talking about an S3 bucket, for example, or any object storage, like it doesn't. You have bucket level permissions. So now you're going to have to figure out how, your data set, is secured, on a row or column level. I mean, this is being worked on. There's decentish solutions to this, but, I think it's still pretty early days with that. And then the questions, the biggest questions that I get from teams, from data teams is this worth learning? Mm-hmm. Is this worth doing? Mm-hmm. Right. Cause these are discussions that are happening in the midst of, many data teams being downsized right now. So expect to do a lot more with a lot less. Mm-hmm. And now you want us to tack on this other technology and maintain that while we're doing everything else, and the question's like, well, what's wrong with just using, Snowflake, Redshift, Databricks, Fabric, whatever. And maybe we come back to this later. So I think it's more the inertia as well, just the existing data teams, just having the time to really put this into the workload. I think that is actually one of the bigger obstacles as well. It's not technology based, but it's but again, no shortage of attention on it. So, and Hoodie's also doing some cool stuff, right? I mean, we talk about Iceberg a lot, but the teams over at Hoodie, they're OneHouse. I mean, they're doing some really interesting work with Hoodie itself, which came out 1.0 in January, then also Xtable. So being able to translate between all the different open table formats, I think that's a pretty exciting development too. Because the question really is also like, how open is it? If we get into one format, do we really like save anything? Or now, mm-hmm. What do we gain by doing this?
Sorry to interrupt, but what's your recommendation now? I mean, let's say, a while back, it was that you had Snowflake proposing Iceberg, you had Databricks on Delta, and Hoodie was more considered to be more for operational workloads. And now, obviously, Databricks acquired, the creators of the Iceberg, former Tabular, the company. And how are things moving forward now? Do I still have to decide? Is interoperability, what's your vision? Will there be one OTF in the end? where are things going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know where it's going. I think it, a lot of it just depends on the adoption. I think this year or next, if it takes off and there's wide adoption, then I think the answer is there. If Xtable gets a lot of traction and you can sort of pick your open table format and it kind of doesn't matter, then maybe that's where it goes. I think the jury is still out. But there's enough money and attention on this. I think it's going to go somewhere. But then I think it's also the big question in my mind is, storage, you know, data gravity used to be this thing, you know, the competitive advantage for companies like, you know, store your data with us. You know, the more data you have, the more locked into our environment you are. I mean, the question as well, does it become a battle of query engines at this point? If everybody is sort of in a DMZ type of a scenario with the data, or do you choose certain platforms if the storage is that much better than the others, right? So Snowflake, you know, they built from the ground up, I think, a very wonderful storage mechanism that works for Snowflake with micro partitioning and, you know, everything that they've described throughout their various papers. I mean, it's a work of art, you know, but I guess we'll find out.
Listen, Big Data and AI World is coming up again. On the 4th and 5th of June in Frankfurt, we'll have 4 stages full of presentations and lots of technology providers showcasing the latest and greatest. So this is a great opportunity to get an update how AI is influencing data and analytics. We'll get more productive with it. We have new user interfaces. We'll see how AI is taking data and analytics to the next level. And that's best seen live, in person. And Big Data and AI World in Frankfurt on the 4th and 5th of June is the best place to do that. I will be there too. And I always appreciate if you, dear listeners, stop by, have a quick chat. Let me know what's on your mind. What are your latest projects? What is your wish list for this podcast? Everything can be discussed. Looking forward to see you there. Yeah. But what's going on in query engines? Maybe talk a little bit more about that. I mean, there are some specific vendors out there, like Dremio, Starburst, and others. So what's happening in that field?
It's pretty interesting. Like, you know, Starburst is out there. I think they're you know, pushing Lakehouse really heavily, and but they're sort of the opposite, right? Where they're sort of almost the inverse of a monolithic query engine, because they can go and query various data sources and bring them together. So, you know, I see them doing some cool stuff. I mean, Spark 4.0 is almost out. So that's pretty cool to see. I remember using 1.0 way back in the day. It's crazy that it's still around. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, that's not going anywhere. You know, they got upstarts too, like E6 Data. They're doing some, you know, at least they have a proprietary engine that's, you know, extremely fast, very, very fast. And so, yeah. And then at the same time, you know, you got things like Flink that I think are getting a lot of adoption, you know, kind of universally. So it's an exciting time for query engines for sure. You know, at the same time, what I find interesting is, you know, we talk about query engines, but then I also see people using DuckDB. Uh-huh. For more data processing now, uh-huh. Right? And we're talking about not just on a local machine, but, in a distributed DuckDB, using that either in a distributed sensor. There was an article that came out with DeepSeek, I think, was using it recently. And then, I think maybe it was Okta. They talked about something late last year about, about how they're using DuckDB just in AWS Lambda functions. I thought was pretty cool, right? So,
maybe for the listeners that don't know DuckDB, what do you see is the most interesting part here?
I mean, just the fact that DuckDB really was meant to be an analytics database you could run on a single core on a machine, mm-hmm. Right? So, yeah. I mean, you could run it on your laptop and it you know, scales really well and it does a fantastic job at all laptop queries. But that's starting to get a lot of adoption, right? So it's interesting because you have these, you know, on one hand, these big data discussions, big data, quote unquote, where you're talking giant cloud vendors and put all your data here. And at the same time, when you look at the, you know, even the latest generation of MacBook Air that just came out with the M4 chip, I mean, that thing's a beast. it's 24 gigs of RAM and 10 cores, CPU cores, I think. And I mean, that's plenty powerful to run a lot of workloads. So what I'm also seeing is actually the discussions of, you know, do we even need to pay cloud providers at all for our data? Or if we do, do we select workloads where that's appropriate? And do we bring it back for local processing for cost efficiencies and so forth? So that's a pretty big trend I see. You know, DuckDB, Polar's, you know, doing a lot of local data processing, actually. So that's wasn't in the cards because we sort of in this cloud first world where everything is like, you know, the inevitability is we're all going to be doing these, you know, all the workloads are going to be in the big cloud vendors. But I don't think that's the case, actually. It's not completely.
Yeah. There's an interesting study saying that almost 90% of companies are looking into repatriation of data, especially the data platforms seem to be a driver for this. Cost obviously is a topic. But do you see that as the only driver, or are there other reasons why companies think about, again, like repatriating or not even going to the cloud for their data platforms?
Yeah, I mean, cost is obviously, that's been the big topic for a couple of years now, and I think rightfully so. But, you know, I mean, I was recently in the EU, and discussions were definitely coming up about, do we want to use the US versions of cloud vendors, or do we want to start looking at maybe more local suppliers for our compute? Mm-hmm. So I think that's, it's not necessarily repatriation, but it's more of a, you know, maybe a shift before you'll have your data. So that was a new one, right? I didn't see that. Well, in retrospect, everything's obvious, but that wasn't one I'd heard this time last year. But I think just more control over your data as well. Mm-hmm. Especially with AI, what's interesting is if you are able to get your hands on GPU cards, there is an argument to definitely bring your data back versus do it in the cloud. It's going to be substantially cheaper. You're doing lots of training runs in your data just to do it locally versus renting out cloud GPUs if you're even able to get them, right? Like, good luck, getting the capacity if you need it. So yeah. Those are some of them. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's a topic. I'm not sure, maybe even more in Europe than in the US. I see AI also as a driver for this, that companies get more concerned about their competitive advantages. And if it's now increasingly seen that it's in the data, and that it's really, the data makes the difference, not the technical infrastructure, the models you're using, because that, I think, will all be pretty commoditized. Then I see an increasing awareness about that. And that then means that we start to have discussions about a topic I didn't hear before. It's called data sovereignty. Can't even pronounce it properly. It's like a new topic, but it's exactly that the, let's say, more regulated industries had that a lot, that they obviously had to take care of the data and were very concerned about where is it stored and so on. But I think this is spreading right now. And this leads to exactly these discussions. Yeah. So where is it? Where is it hosted? Do I do it on-prem? So I agree. It's an interesting discussion that it's not, let's say, 100% cloud anymore. But on the other hand, I mean, a lot of innovation is happening with software as a service in the cloud. Yeah. So it's,
it's fascinating. Yeah. I mean, I'm holding like a Raspberry Pi here. I mean, this thing, I mean, I have a ton of these around the house and I do a lot of workloads on them because they're cheap and disposable. Right. And, I don't have to pay for, ongoing, cloud servers. So
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think, things are, I think, getting more differentiated. Maybe that's the right way to see it.
Yeah,
so
yeah, I think it's good. Not. Yeah.
And by the way, the companies that are thinking about or doing it are repatriating data. At the same time, they're also moving data workloads to the cloud. Yeah? It's not like a one-way street. You go this or this. It's you do both and you get more differentiated about what to do where. Yeah? Where's data that I don't want to give out, and other things where you don't have a problem with that. So it's gets more complicated, but on the other hand, you have you want more control, you want more security and so on. That's what I'm. Last topic I would like to talk to you about is, because that's where we met at an event, Helsinki Data Week. that was quite dominated by topics like modeling, data automation. Yeah, the prominent vendors were vendors like Agile Data Engine, Warescape, Vaultspeed. So the typical data automation vendors. I give you my view on that space. I think it generates quite a lot of value for the companies that are using it. But at the same time, I see that most of the vendors did not grow to be very big. So somehow there seems to be a reservation in companies to actually use or buy and use these tools. I have to say, we did some in-depth research here that the vendors are growing. Yeah? So there is obviously some momentum in that market, but still, yeah, maybe Warescape is a bit of an exception, but the others are not really big. Yeah? So they are still in the development phase. So first of all, do you see the same? And secondly, why? What's your take? why?
Are you talking about the data automation space? Yeah. Does that include things like integration or?
Sorry, say again?
Does that include things like data integration?
Well, I mean, the data automation space in my perception has two things. I mean, one is the modeling of data, and then obviously you have metadata that describes the data integration part, but it's a little bit like a little different approach to the classical data integration.
Yeah, I it's interesting. So in the States, at least the companies that you mentioned, I mean, I think, you know, the two of those, at least, were data vault centric, right? Warescape traditionally has been, and then Vaultspeed, obviously, it's in the name. But it's interesting. So in Europe, I get the sense that data vault's more popular, and so the tooling around that is probably more widely used there. In the US, I would say that an analogous tool might be something like DBT, data build tool. So that's I think that dominates a lot of data and analytical engineering in the States. I think that because then if you look at like sort of low code tools, maybe if you're looking from at least a transformation automation, right? Like Matillion might be a second one that's pretty popular here in the States, but it's different because I think data modeling practices in the United States, if I noticed this, we're different than the rest of the world. By we, I mean the Americans. It's a bit more of a free for all here. I don't get the sense that there's established orthodox ways that people universally try and do. And if you want to automate it, right, I think that there's a tendency because it feels like there's kind of some camps where at least in my observations, the tendency is to go towards more coded, like, you know, hand coded or AI coded technologies and approaches. And so with the end result, hopefully being the same thing that the automated tools would provide. That's what I see. Hopefully I answered your question. I'm not sure I did, but.
Yeah. But do you know why? I mean, we had this like 20 years ago, yeah, that the whole industry moved from coding to tool supported definition of data integration workflows. And it seemed to me that we, yeah, it's rather more a step back, yeah, the popularity of more code-oriented approaches. And now the question is maybe, first of all, why? And secondly, will there be the next evolution step that we go again back to more tool-based? Or today we would call it low-code, no-code, but it's basically the same.
I mean, I think I always view everything in going in pendulums. Mm-hmm. So the world when DBT came out in particular, I think it was around 2016, I believe it was when I first saw it. The world before that was just, you know, typically writing SQL, warts and all associated with that. What DBT gave was, I think, a very concise way of writing reusable SQL, much like you would code in a templated way, at least. So if you'd written like apps and, you know, Ruby on Rails or Django, it should be pretty familiar with you how to templatize your code and so forth. But I think it opened up a lot of doors. At the same time, I think if you don't know what you're doing from a practice perspective, like if you don't understand data modeling as a discipline, this allows you to do dumb things more quickly, as I say. So this is what happens often, right? But I think people who are well equipped and know what they're doing using these tools, they do a great job. But I, you know, one of my friends, she showed me a DBT workload, I think, where there were just hundreds of different models in this workflow. And I was like, this is insane. It was all one workflow. I just had to, I think, I don't know. It was sad to see. So, so I think it just depends, right? But if the pendulum swings back to low code, no code, I think it's going to be with the assistance of a lot of AI at this point. Rules-based, heuristic-based stuff is at least going to be complemented by AI and LLMs. So that's, I think, going to be the big, big difference. And inevitably, I think that's where it's all going. I don't think we're taking a step back to, you know, handcrafting our code by hand without AI. I just don't see it. I mean, there are some people that do that. I think one of my friends, he is one of the co-creators of DuckDB. I watched him hand code a DuckDB extension while we're having lunch, and he doesn't use AI, at least right there. So there's actually some, I think, great engineers who are, don't need it. But I think increasingly the lines between no code and low code and heavy code it's going to be very blurred. Precisely because AI is going to be writing a lot of the code for us.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That actually closes the circle to our initial back topic to what we discussed. And
pendulums. Yep.
Pendulums, exactly. And our time is up. So, Joe, thanks a lot. That, I think, was a great overview, a lot of interesting topics we could touch on. It's great to hear your insights and your opinions about those. And I'm sure I see you soon again at one event or the other. And I say till then, all the best to you. Bye-bye.
Bye.